The MarTech Podcast is a proud member of the I Hear Everything Podcast Network. Looking to launch or scale your podcast? I Hear Everything delivers podcast production, growth, and monetization solutions that transform your words into profit. Ready to give your brand a voice? Then visit IHearEverything.com.
From advertising to software as a service to data.
Across all of our programs and clients, we've seen a 55 to 65% open rate.
Getting brands authentically integrated into content performs better than TV advertising.
Typical lifespan of an article is about 24 to 36 hours.
If we're reaching out to the right person with the right message and a clear call to action, then it's just a matter of timing.
Welcome to the MarTech Podcast, a member of the I Hear Everything Podcast Network. In this podcast, you'll hear the stories of world-class marketers that use technology to drive business results and achieve career success. Here's the host of the MarTech Podcast, Benjamin Shapiro.
Welcome to the MarTech Podcast. I'm Benjamin Shapiro, the executive producer of the MarTech Podcast, and today we've got a special episode for you, which is going to be guest hosted by Juan Mendoza, the author of the MarTech Weekly Newsletter. Juan is a recovering MarTech consultant turned creator who writes an amazing weekly newsletter about the MarTech industry, and I'm thrilled to invite him and some of his friends to take the mic and share their knowledge with you, our loyal MarTech Podcast listeners. All right, here's a special episode of the MarTech Podcast, guest hosted by Juan Mendoza, the author of the MarTech Weekly Newsletter.
Well, welcome back, MarTechers. My name is Juan Mendoza. I'm from the MarTech Weekly Newsletter. I'm your guest host today on the MarTech Podcast. Today, we're going to discuss safeguarding creativity and web traffic in the age of AI. Joining me today is the very smart, very intelligent, very handsome Mark McCollum. He's the Executive Vice President of Innovation at Raptive. It's a new kind of creator economy company on a mission to really empower creators and their independence. They offer revenue, audience, business solutions, and much more guidance for creators and enterprise publishers. So Mark and I are going to discuss protecting creators from AI-powered copyright infringement. There's been a lot of talk about this in the media, a lot of lawsuits flying around, and increasingly publishers are blocking AI platforms such as OpenAI and Google's Gemini from crawling their website to collect data for their own AI models. So this conversation could not be more relevant right now in the age of generative AI. So with that said, here's our conversation with Mark McCollum, the Executive Vice President of Innovation at Raptive. Mark, how are you doing today? We were just discussing beforehand that you're in LA and the weather's not so great, but how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Juan. Great to connect with you. I'm actually in LA because we are having an event with 100 of our biggest and best creators here in LA. So it's exciting. After this podcast, I'm heading to dinner with them. So happy to be here. Yes, the weather's not great, but otherwise it's an exciting time.
Well, that's very exciting. So when you get a bunch of creators in the room, and I'm assuming you're giving them some cocktails and drinks, well, I can imagine it's probably going to get a bit wild.
We'll see how wild it gets. There's definitely a lot of energy. I'll put it that way.
Well, I've been following Raptive a little bit because at the MarTech Weekly, we're an independent media business, and we're very interested in how Raptive works. And so before we get into this whole concept of IP infringement, rights, and generative AI, and why you care about that, I would love for you to tell us a bit more about Raptive and what the business actually does.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And Juan, it's great to be talking to someone like you because you yourself are an independent content creator focused on this industry. And of course, there are hundreds of thousands of others like you who are trying to make it in this industry. And that's the center of what Raptive is all about. So we're really a transformational media company that's built for creators. And we say transformational because we think of ourselves really differently than traditional digital media. We focus on independent content creators and helping them build audiences and build businesses for the long term. We have one of the largest audiences on the internet, and we're really proud of the work that we do. As we think about content creators, they, people like you, are the heartbeat of the internet. You're producers of content, nucleus of online communities, setters of trends, shapers of culture, and making a living as a creator, as I'm sure you know, involves a lot more than just creativity. There's figuring out how to compete in this environment, which is a rapidly changing media ecosystem. Being sophisticated digital publishers, that can be a full-time job into itself. well beyond just the creation of content. And that's where Raptive comes in. We work with thousands of creators to help them build audience, to help them monetize, help them build their businesses, and have them focus on what they're great at, which is creating great content. And that creator first strategy is what's built Raptive to become what's now the seventh largest online media property. We're number one in food, number one in family, number one in home, number one in lifestyle. So we're really a prime destination for advertisers that are seeking scalable access to engaged communities that are driven by content creators. That's what we're all about.
That's incredible, because I guess there's this situation we have right now where a lot of creators have been riding the algorithm. And what I mean by that is that they've been creating content for years on Instagram and YouTube, and the social media aspect of this cannot be ignored, where a lot of those creators found an audience, found traction in the early days, and they've built up an ability to actually monetize and build a business around it, whether it be selling other products or doing events or all kinds of things in which they can monetize an audience. But the algorithm approach with social media is increasingly giving creators a bad deal. So it sounds like Raptive is giving creators an ability to kind of own more of their audience, to have more control over what they're doing with that audience in terms of monetization, and kind of giving them perhaps a bit of an off-ramp from just, say, directly dealing with YouTube or directly dealing with Instagram in terms of your audience and reach and whatnot. So that's kind of how I understand it. It's a bit of an off-ramp for that, but also in a way to kind of empower those businesses to build. The other side of it, which I'm interested in your thoughts, is that, you know, we've also had, particularly during COVID-19, we had Substack and then recently Beehive, two pretty prominent newsletter platforms. And they've been really in this space to go, they literally have recruited and paid for content creators to create email newsletter content on their platforms. So there's this interesting aspect here where a lot of tech companies are trying to get creators to do their own thing as well and kind of sit and then build their own audiences via email addresses and phone numbers and other sort of first-party data. So where does Raptive sit in that landscape? Are you guys more on the Substack edge, or are you more sort of in the programmatic slash open media side of things? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, historically, Raptive's business has been serving what we call web-first creators. So creators that started their business on the open web by launching websites, whether it was a blog or, you know, a way to engage their audience directly through a website. As you mentioned, there are plenty of creators out there that start other ways. Some start in social, some start as YouTubers, some start with newsletters or podcasts, and there are other ways. What we find is that over time, most creators end up being multi-channel, so working across all of those different media. But the ones that we have historically served have been those that have started on the web. And more recently, we've begun to expand to creators that start through other channels, and it's all converging at this point. You know, you make the point around creators that fully own their audience and have direct relationships versus those that have to work through the platforms. And the truth is, most creators need to play both sides of that. Certainly when a creator has a website that's theirs, they're able to have a direct relationship to their audience through that website, and they're able to monetize 100% of the revenue that comes into the web. For those that have newsletters, it's pretty similar. You will own 100% of the relationship and not have to share with the platforms. The other types of creators that sit on YouTube or certainly sit on social are highly dependent on the algorithms, as you said, to engage the audience, and certainly are sharing revenue, usually a material scale, with the platforms themselves. What we tend to find and where we tend to guide creators when we're working with them in the early days is those platforms are a great place for discovery, to meet your audience and begin to engage them. But as soon as you convert them into your own experiences, the more you're going to be able to create value and sustained engagement. As it relates to businesses like Substack and Beehive, great businesses, we're big fans of them. Both of them are SaaS software businesses at the core, so their business model is different than ours. We operate as a services business that provides services to the creator economy. We're not a software platform.
Yeah, well, there's an argument because Substack had a bit of heat because of the platforming of Nazi content. A lot of creators in the tech world kind of abandoned Substack because of it and their policies, because part of it was that Substack and Beehive and others, they're turning more into social networks each and every day. They've got their own notes feature. For example, Substack has its own notes feature. They've got all these alternative ways to monetize an audience. The Beehive has this creative network where you can kind of share other newsletters with your audience and things. So there's this very interesting sort of SaaS play, which creators are kind of bristling at to say, ooh, they almost feel like they could be locked in here. It started off as like a way to get independence. Increasingly, it's like a lot of creators, for example, Ryan Broderick from Garbage Day, really great creator newsletter. He left Substack because he saw it increasingly as the longer you're in it, the more you're locked into their network effects, almost as a social media platform. And so it's interesting that Raptive is more of a services business that's helping creators become more independent and hopefully navigating this maze of not being locked into any single platform or network effect and going direct to their audience as well. So that's fascinating. And thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And just to add, we don't lock in our creators at all. We have to earn their business every day. They engage with us at their own will. And if they decide they want to move on to someone else, they can at any point. So that's how we operate.
It's enabling them to build their own media properties, their own direct relationships, as opposed to join this network effect and then never leave because you all your audience is in there and all of your growth opportunities and revenue was in there and stuff as well. So yeah, I can definitely see what's kind of needed for those kinds of services because look, let's face it, content creators probably often are not the best business operators or strategic thinkers in terms of commercializing a business or content. So they're in it to create the content, right? They're artists, they're creators, they're thinkers, they're novelists, they're people that are very good at creating something an audience really loves and wants to come back for, not necessarily a business strategist or a business operator. And I can imagine you get a lot of that at Raptive as well. Hey, like the person that's like, I don't know where to go with monetization or how do I figure out how to hire people for my team and keep them happy? There's all of these incredible questions when the business starts growing as well. So it is fascinating thinking about it. But I do want to squeeze in some questions here about AI and generative AI shifts now. So we found some stats recently that roughly about 45% of top publishers, so this is research that just came out of Reuters, so a very credible firm. They've just done a survey on this. About 45% of top publishers with at least 1 million monthly visits on their websites, they've actually blocked AI crawlers, mostly from OpenAI, but then secondary from Google. Now, that to me is a very different situation from 20 years ago where Google search was just something that every publisher wanted to be a part of. They're just like, yes, come and crawl my website, want to be on search, want to be discovered on the internet. And it was a fantastic deal. But now we're seeing the inverse of that where a lot of these publishers are not wanting these AI platforms to crawl their content. What are you seeing in this space? How are you seeing the risks around copyright infringement, use of IP, and the hard work that's put into creating this content just to be sent into an AI platform?
A lot has changed in the last 20 years, to say the least. You know, before we talk about AI blockers and crawlers, it's worth noting that before anyone had the option to block, all of the major AI companies crawled the entire internet and have trained their models. So any decision that an individual publisher makes to indicate they don't want to be crawled anymore doesn't change the fact that anything that they created before 2022 has already been crawled and trained the models. So the entire topic is really around net new content going forward, which isn't nothing, but if you think about the entire backlog of content that's on the internet that's already been crawled, that has already happened. In the last couple of years, since OpenAI made its big splash with its generative AI innovations and Google soon followed, both of those organizations, as well as others, have used copyrighted information, content, and data to train their models. And they did that, as I was just saying, without the consent of any of the owners of the content, whether it's a big publisher or an independent content creator, and certainly without any compensation. So that's just a fact. They went through that process. They built their models on that. What they've since done is use all of that content for their own commercial purposes. And they're doing that in some cases to the detriment of the individual content creators who were the original sources of content and who are the ongoing sources of content. So our belief, you know, speaking plainly, is that that in and of itself is copyright infringement. And the companies that have done that, who are pointing to the fair use rules, our belief is that fair use does not apply. In large part, it doesn't apply because they're using it for their own commercial purpose, which is part of the definition of fair use, that it can't be used for a commercial or competing purpose against the original content provider. So from a philosophical as well as a practical perspective, we think what they have done violates the law. Now, you're asking about blockers. The two circumstances are different if you look at the two big AI companies, in OpenAI and Google. With OpenAI, we have advised our creators to indicate to OpenAI that they don't want any future content to be crawled and trained upon. But with Google, it's more difficult because the opt-out would also opt the creators out of Google search. And for nearly every content creator, that would be a problem for their business.
Time for a one-minute break to hear from our presenting sponsor, Mutinex. In 1919, John Wanamaker said, "Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. I just don't know which half. Well, the advertising landscape has changed since then, and instead of reaching your audience on two channels, you're probably reaching them on 20. Turns out John didn't know how easy he had it. But that doesn't mean that you should give up on striving towards marketing effectiveness. No matter how complex your marketing strategy is, Mutinex Growth OX is the market mix modeling platform that measures the impact of marketing on your bottom line. Mutinex's market mix modeling platform calibrates your insights against the latest market conditions so you can make media and marketing investment decisions confidently and quickly. Ready to take your team from I think to I know? Then join brands like Samsung, ING, and Asahi who make better marketing decisions with Mutinex. Mutinex Growth OX, your best decision starts here. To learn more about Mutinex, go to mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co. Okay, here's the rest of today's interview. A special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Mutinex. Ready to take your team from I think to I know? Then join brands like Samsung, ING, and Asahi who make better marketing decisions with Mutinex. Mutinex Growth OX, the marketing mix modeling platform that makes measuring ROI fast, easy, and cost-effective. Request a demo at mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co.
I can see the risks. I can see the challenge with this because the value exchange with search historically has been you provide content for our platform and we help you get discovered. We drive traffic. And the whole SEO industry is predicated on that, is optimizing your website in order to drive more traffic. And it's a free thing. And it's, I guess, neutral because it's an algorithmic sorting based on what people are clicking and interested in it on. And then also suitability to keywords and whatnot. So that value exchange has always, I guess, worked. You know, it's lasted a good 25 years. So overall, we can go, tick, that's worked, more or less. Of course, there's not going to be people that aren't happy with how much Google controls in terms of their web traffic. But overall, it's worked. Generative AI just seems completely opposite to that. It just seems as though that there's no clear value exchange. It's like crawl the data, use it, and then people can get answers from the AI model or get help or feedback, whatever thing they want to use for it without any sort of direct attribution. So do you think the crux of this problem is attribution or is it something else?
Attribution is certainly a part of it. If there was attribution with clear links back to the source content, that would at least provide both a user with some sort of credibility against the content that they're consuming, and would also provide the original creator of the content with some traffic that would come back in. But yeah, the entire premise of AI responses is that they're machine generated based on training and inputs from multiple sources. And therefore, by definition, they don't provide specific citations, except for in cases where the prompt may ask for a specific source or citation. But generically speaking, that's not the case.
And, you know, the thing that I think a lot of creators are not recognizing just yet is that they think that this is something that's in the niches. It's like a new innovative thing, something that people are trying, kind of like a toy, more or less. And, you know, what we're finding at the MarTech Weekly is that this is not something that is small. The use of generative AI is not just people in Silicon Valley trying it out. This is something that people are increasingly using. At one example, we have OpenAI. They're getting more than 1.8 billion monthly global website visitors to ChatGPT, 1.8 billion a month. So they're rivaling some of the biggest tech firms in the world just on web traffic. And if you think about it like that, you're like, wow, that's pretty incredible. OpenAI went from doing 200 million in revenue to, I think, 2 billion in a year. Basically 10x their revenue in serious ways. And so we're not necessarily dealing with a niche thing. Like I'm sure you remember just as well as I do when chatbots were all the rage back in 2017, everyone had to have a chatbot on social media and on their website and stuff. This is not that. This is actually ChatGPT and OpenAI becoming a new consumer channel. They may not see it like that just yet, but I'm sure a lot of consumers are making buying decisions and researching and finding products and I've used it myself by going back and forth with ChatGPT and having a conversation.
Yeah, for sure. And listen, it's innovation and it's exciting. And speaking for myself, as well as for other leaders at Raptive, we're AI optimists. Like we think this is incredible. We think that it's as revolutionary as the printing press. And of course it has a ton of traction like you were just describing. And of course the revenue is 10X and it should be 100X because what these technologies can do is remarkable, but it needs to be done ethically and responsibly and legally. that's our perspective and defining a framework for what is ethical AI and what is responsible AI. It's a challenge because the technology is moving so quickly and we don't have these ethical or legal frameworks in place yet, not in the US or really anywhere globally. That's the inherent challenge. But there's nothing about what you were describing that I think is inherently bad. It's exciting and it's free market, and we want these companies to continue to innovate, but we just want them to do it in a way that's fair. And when you build a business, any business, that's based on inputs from others, the others who provide the inputs for that commercial purpose should be compensated. If you were building a home that was made out of bricks, the person who made the bricks would be getting part of the revenue from selling the home, right? Because you have to pay the suppliers. And in the case of AI, content creators on the internet are the suppliers. And the way that the lack of frameworks create a situation where they're not being compensated as a part of that. And to make it worse, the AI companies are then creating solutions and products that effectively compete with or diminish the business of these independent content creators.
So I'm building a house and I turn around to my bricklayer that's slaving away in the hot sun. I say, isn't it great that you can set these bricks out so that your bricks can get exposure to the neighborhood?
Right.
That's basically what Google has been saying for a long time.
Well, your bricks can get exposure, but we're not going to tell anybody that they're your bricks.
Yeah, no, but you can't put any branding on the bricks, and the bricks are covered up in something else so people can't see it. I mean, that's the thing. It's the hard work. It's the people in the content coal mines that make almost all the major platforms work. If the content creators stop, everything stops. Like Twitter, X, Meta, Facebook, OpenAI, they're all empty shells without the human input. And I think that's a very interesting point to raise here philosophically about, well, these businesses have grown very large, but they've still got so much reliant on the humans, the people, to actually create the stuff that they're monetizing off the back of. So I think your analogy is correct, is that, yeah, people should be compensated. If their house is built by bricks, the bricks should be purchased. If their house is built by content creators slaving away trying to build an audience, then they should be compensated in some way.
And that is the fundamental principle of copyright law.
Exactly.
Which is to say that I create a copyrighted asset and you want to use that asset. Number one, you have to ask me. And number two, you have to pay me. And simply put, that's what's in the best interest of not only the independent content creators, but candidly, the entire publishing industry. It's the basis for the New York Times lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft. And it's a fundamental principle of how economies are meant to work. So as I mentioned before, part of our challenge is that we're dealing with what is arguably the fastest moving industry in the world right now, the big tech industry focused on AI innovation. And we're seeking remedies from what is probably the slowest moving entity in the world, which is the US government. That's a dichotomy that's really hard to rationalize, because with even the best interests that individual politicians may have, getting anything done in Washington is nearly impossible right now, particularly in an election year. But candidly, at any time, there has not been substantive tech regulation since the 90s, which is part of the reason why we're sitting here having this conversation today, because we don't have laws that protect independent content creators from big tech.
What I see is that, for example, as you call out, the New York Times filing a lawsuit, book publishers joining together and doing a class action lawsuit against OpenAI to say they don't want their content being used in these AI systems. But then you have like other platforms, for example, Apple has been doing a lot on data tracking and preventing marketers and advertisers to track people on their apps and on their platforms and using Safari and whatnot. So it seems as though, because as you rightly point out, tech innovation is changing so quickly, but regulation is moving so slowly. What that means is that a lot of these companies have kind of take the matters in their own hands, and they have to sue people. They have to cut off tracking because the government regulation is just not there. And it seems as though it's going to take a long time for that to shake out. But I do want to get into our part two, which is our when we see you next time on the next episode, which is how much do creators actually get into this space? Google's Search Generative Experience, SGE, which is Google's, I guess, their first iteration of using generative AI in the search experience. Are there opportunities there for creators? Are there opportunities for monetization, for audience growth? What would that look like? And so I'm very much looking forward to inviting you back, Mark, and talking a bit more about search generative experience. So catch us next time. That wraps up our first episode with Mark McCollum. He's the Executive Vice President of Innovation at Raptive. In part two of our interview, as I mentioned, we'll be talking about the search generative experience feature in Google and what that means for website traffic and creators. If you can't wait until the next episode, would like to learn more about Mark, you can find a link to his LinkedIn profile in our show notes. You can also contact him on Twitter, where his handle is at Mark McCollum, his first name and last name. Or you can visit his company website at raptive.com. Mark, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights.
Juan, it was terrific. Thanks again.
Okay, that wraps up this episode of the MarTech Podcast. Thanks to our guest host, Juan Mendoza, the author of the MarTech Weekly Newsletter. If you'd like to get in touch with Juan, you could find a link to his LinkedIn profile in our show notes, or you can contact him on Twitter. His handle is Juan Mendoza, but it's spelled crazy pants. It's JU4NMEND0Z4. Or it's a little easier to just visit his company's website, which is themartechweekly.com. Just one more link in our show notes I'd like to tell you about. If you didn't have a chance to take notes while you were listening to this podcast, head over to martechpod.com, where we have summaries of all of our episodes and contact information for our guests. You can also subscribe to our weekly newsletters, and you can even send us your topic suggestions or your marketing questions, which we'll answer live on our show. Of course, you can always reach out on social media. Our handle is MarTechPod, MARTECHPOD, on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Or you can contact me directly. My handle is Ben J. Schaap, BenJShap. And if you haven't subscribed yet and you want a daily stream of marketing and technology knowledge in your podcast feed, we're going to publish an episode every day this year. So hit the subscribe button in your podcast app, and we'll be back in your feed tomorrow morning. All right, that's it for today. But until next time, my advice is to just focus on keeping your customers happy.
Thanks for listening to the MarTech Podcast, an I Hear Everything production. Looking to launch or scale a podcast like this one for your brand? Then visit iheareverything.com.